My name's Rachel, and like most people who survive adolescence, I know what it's like to be politically surprised. I know what it's like to have some, you know, to be so convinced, to be so sure of your politics, to know that you're right, and then have some new piece of information come in and honestly completely fuck that up, tell you that you don't understand the world as well as you thought you did. And that's not fun. I don't wish it on anyone necessarily, but in another sense I do. Because I think that it's one of the most healthy and one of the most constructive things that can happen to us. Worldview should shift and change when we get new information. You know, an unchanging worldview becomes a dogma, and that's not something that I'm interested in. So when faced with the pain of cognitive dissonance, you have two choices. You can dig in your heels. You can try to beat the odds and maintain that worldview despite conflicting information. Or on the other hand, you can choose to critically re-examine your worldview with that new evidence in mind. So Cynthia Enloe is, I had a quote. I only have a couple slides, so I think we can just leave it. Okay, that's fine. Cynthia Enloe is a feminist who wrote a book called The Curious Feminist. And in a chapter called The Surprise Feminist, she says, and I agree, I have come to think that the capacity to be surprised and to admit it is an undervalued feminist attribute. To be surprised is to have one's current explanatory notions and thus one's predictive assumptions thrown into confusion. In both academic life and activist public life in most cultures, one is socialized to deny surprise. It is as if admitting surprise jeopardizes one's hard-earned credibility. And credibility, something necessarily bestowed by others, is the bedrock of status. So a few years ago, I encountered some information that surprised me. It was a conception of gender that was new to me, and it differed from anything that I had ever heard before. My existing conception of gender at the time sounded something like this. I figured that, you know, this probably sounds familiar. I figured that gender identity is a personal, individual quality that's possessed internally by each person. I thought it was the subjective perception of an individual of their position on a spectrum between masculine and feminine. And I thought that masculine and feminine were sets of aesthetic choices and behavior patterns that were neutral. It was a spectrum, but there was no value judgment assigned to any point on that spectrum. It was just a neutral choice. I thought that each person's gender identity was innate and that it was independent of their biological sex. They had no connection in my mind. So I knew that each person was born with a biological sex, but that was apolitical. It was gender became political only because we were prevented from expressing it the way that we wanted to. That was where the harm came in for me at that time. So that was the oppressive part. Everyone was forced to identify themselves in these two little boxes, and both of those were equally bad if you didn't want to be there. And I thought that resistance meant resisting those aesthetic choices, you know, adopting parts of that stereotype that were not traditional for your biological sex. That was the only method of resistance that had ever really been presented to me for what I understood to be the harm, the only harm that I knew of gender. So like most feminists of my generation, I wasn't taught to question the existence of that system itself. I had never heard of such a thing. The dominant patriarchal culture and the mainstream feminism I considered myself a part of, you know, they differed on how exactly we should treat gender. You know, one thought that it should be rigidly enforced, the other thought that we should, you know, try and mess with it a little bit, try and make it more bearable, try and reform it. But they both were in agreement that it was natural, inevitable, and that it wasn't questioned. So questioning the reason for it all, asking why gender exists, was unthinkable to me up until rather embarrassingly recently. But I couldn't avoid that question forever, and by chance, by luck, I was introduced to an alternative conception of what gender is and what gender is for. And that alternative conception was this. Some of you are also familiar with this one. Gender is a hierarchical system that maintains the subordination of females as a class to males as a class through force. Gender is a material system of power which uses violence and psychological coercion to exploit female labor, sex, reproduction, emotional support, etc., for the benefit of male people. Gender is not voluntary or natural, since no person is naturally subordinate to any other. Biological sex is a physical feature of each person, and those deemed female at birth are socialized by the culture into femininity, which means ritualized displays of submission. All of the stereotypes associated with femininity are associated with submission. So why is that oppressive? Well, it's oppressive because it's based on subordination and domination. It's oppressive because it is based on oppression as its unifying principle. And with this definition, the vision of resistance is different. In this definition, the subordinate class, female people, organize to overthrow male supremacy and thus the entire system of gender. So those two definitions differ considerably, and they were completely new to me. The second definition was completely new to me. They flung my understanding of feminism, of the world, of the entire culture I live in, into chaos. And as Cynthia Enloe put it, my current explanatory notions, and thus my predictive assumptions, were thrown into confusion. It was not a pleasant experience at first. But at that point, I was faced with a choice, one that I think everyone is faced with at a certain point. I could ignore new ideas, dismiss them, pretend I was unchanged, and continue business as usual, or I could reexamine my feminism in light of this new information. And I chose the latter. Because of that choice, I've lost friends. I've had other friends pressured to publicly cut ties with me or else face social and professional consequences because of my politics. Many, though not all, caved under that pressure. I've been stalked, intimidated, yelled at, and ridiculed. More lies have been printed about me than I can count. I've been bullied, harassed, threatened, and organizations and individuals that have dared to work with me have been harassed and pressured. I've seen my friends attacked and physically bullied for questioning the current dogma around gender. That goes for female and male friends, had that experience, but sort of differently charged when it's directed towards women, of course. But whatever I've gone through in the last year, let me be clear that I've gotten off real easy to many people that I can think of, many other women in my generation, because I have a community that have supported me through that backlash, something that most women in my position are not lucky enough to have. You know, I'm by no means the first woman to face this kind of backlash for questioning gender, and the current trend we're seeing here today, and we have seen with this conference, among other things, is just an extension of the same misogyny that has been metastasizing for millennia. It is nothing new. But I've gotten off easy because I have that community and I have guidance from women who have been fighting this fight since before I was born. Most women in my generation don't have that kind of support on this issue. Women have written to me or come up to me after talks and thanked me for speaking publicly, but admitted that they could never be so public with their beliefs, even though they believe similar things. And I don't blame them. They're afraid of losing their jobs, losing their communities. They're afraid of the death threats and the stalking and the bullying, and who could blame them? They don't have all the support that I've been lucky enough to rely on. So when I list the things that have happened to me in the last year, I don't do it to complain, because I had plenty of warning about what was going to happen. I knew exactly what was going to happen, and I don't regret it. I do it because I want other women in my position to know that they're not alone in the backlash and the hatred that they're facing. And I do it because I know that most other women who are not as privileged as I am don't have the option of saying the things that I say in public and being able to withstand the consequences. So it's my responsibility. So my feminist framework was thrown into confusion. That's kind of where my story relating to this begins. And in response and kind of in tribute to my own cognitive dissonance, something that I've grown to appreciate as a learning experience, I wrote a presentation called The End of Gender, which attempted to explain how and why my definition of gender had shifted, what led me to these new conclusions, and why did I think that those new conclusions were important. So that talk got put up online almost exactly a year ago today, actually. It feels like yesterday. And in the last year, it's been extremely, sometimes excruciatingly educational. And in particular, I have learned so much about what we're allowed to say, the ideas we're allowed to have about gender, and the ones that we are not allowed to say, the things you will be punished for stating out loud or for even thinking. So in that presentation, I tried to get across two main ideas, and I've come to discover that these two ideas amount to an Orwellian-style thought crime in the current political climate around gender. And I think that indicates to me why we need to say them publicly as loudly as we can every opportunity we get. And those two ideas are this. One, female people are a distinct social class with unique experiences, and members of that class experience specific forms of oppression under male supremacy based on the fact that we are female. And the second one is that gender is an inherently oppressive caste system that serves to facilitate and maintain the exploitation of female people under male supremacy. I'm going to read those again just because I base everything I'm talking about today on them, so I kind of want to drive them home. One, female people are a distinct social class with unique experiences, and members of that class experience specific and unique forms of oppression under male supremacy based on the fact that we're female. And the second one, again, is that gender is an inherently oppressive caste system that serves to facilitate and maintain the exploitation of female people under male supremacy. So my question yet again is why? What is it? Why do these two ideas inspire the level of hatred and backlash and fear and silencing that I and many other people in this room have been subject to since we decided to speak up about them? What is it about these that justifies all that? So with each of these, I want to talk about their significance to feminism and the reasons I think it's important that we state them out loud despite the inevitable consequences. And I also want to honestly address some of the criticisms that I've heard directed at them, because as Cynthia Enloe advises, I am a curious feminist and I want to know what's behind these criticisms. I want to analyze them critically. Of course, most of radical feminism's detractors don't bother to engage with these two arguments. So some of the time when I'm railing about these again and again, it's fruitless because the arguments are not the point for some people. It is a lot easier to threaten women to make us afraid than to actually have a constructive adult conversation about something that you disagree with. It is a lot easier to dismiss radical feminism as an outdated relic from an earlier time than to acknowledge and engage with our arguments in a sincere and genuine way. So this argument that radical feminism is wrong because it's old, if it can be called an argument, really falls flat for me, and I think for most radical feminists in my generation, because liberal gender ideology has never been new for us. We're not resisting new ideas. We're reaching for a politics that actually addresses the scope of the misogyny and the male supremacy that we're forced to live under. Young women organize radical feminist conferences, we write gender critical analysis, we fight to maintain the right of female people to organize as a class, we support each other through the intimidation, the threats, and the ostracization that that earns us, and some of us, the lucky ones, benefit from the guidance and support of women who have been fighting this fight since before we were born. Others who don't have the benefit of that came to radicalism because they could see that the current ideology that mainstream feminism espouses is in many cases actively working against the advancement of women's human rights. So we don't appreciate being ignored by those who would take the easy way out in dismissing our politics. It's especially insulting when someone doesn't even engage with your arguments. So that's what I want to do today. I want to draw out and engage these two arguments in a way that most people don't afford us the benefit of doing. So let's start with the first one. Female people are a distinct social class with unique experiences. Now, proponents of the liberal conception of gender would have you believe that the idea of female biology itself is passé and old-fashioned. It's not a relevant framework anymore for talking about what one half of the population goes through. No one is female, they say. Female is just a voluntary social category that anyone can occupy if they choose, regardless of the realities of our bodies and what they mean and what they, earn us in under patriarchy. So the problem with this view is that it renders female-specific oppression totally invisible. It completely erases the fact that some of the oppression that female people go through is because we are female. It is based on that fact. So one glaring example here, one of many, is reproductive exploitation, which happens to female people because we are female. Male people are not reproductively exploited globally. Male people are not forcibly sterilized, something that still happens to women in the prison system in the U.S., particularly women of color, something that has been happening for generations. Male people are not jailed for their miscarriages, as increasing numbers of female people are. They're not imprisoned for failing to carry their pregnancies to term. Male people are not forced to enact a certain role with regard to reproduction. this is not the case. This is a glaring difference. And this is something that we're literally not allowed, we're not afforded the language to talk about under the current gender ideology. So physical sex matters, and it shapes our experiences of exploitation. And one criticism I've gotten for saying this, one that initially gave me pause, I think it has some legitimate points. Did anyone participate or read any of the Gender Week stuff going on recently? There was an article that came out through that called Race Shatters the Idea of Shared Female Experience. And I think that article brought up some good points. I think that there was definite legitimate criticism in that article, but I was named in that article as an example of someone arguing an argument that they were trying to refute. They were saying that by saying that female people experience specific oppression because we're female, I'm somehow saying that all female people experience the same oppression because we're female. And that is not true. Female experience is as diverse as female people are, and things like race and class do shape the specific types of exploitation that female people are subject to. What those forms of exploitation have in common is that they happen to female people because we're female. They happen in different ways based on other social circumstances, but they happen because we're female. And that is something that you are not allowed to notice, much less speak out loud. So that experience is distinct from that which is experienced by male-bodied people, and that remains true no matter how specific male people identify themselves. It's no secret that much of the backlash, not all of it, but much of it, directed at radical feminism, is with regard to its relationship and its stance towards transgenderism. And here's the background. I mean, most of you probably already know this, but for the uninitiated, here's what I think the core of the conflict is. Some people, myself included, believe that the experience of people with female biology is unique. That being born in a genetically female body comes with certain experiences that are not, cannot be shared by people that are not born female. For others, to say that female-bodied people and male trans people have different experiences of the world amounts to blasphemy, and it's punished accordingly. Today, even the use of the word female to describe ourselves and our experiences is often shouted down as transphobic, but without being able to address that reality, the reality of our lives becomes unspeakable, erased. And ask yourself, what system is served by erasing the realities of female experience? The answer, predictably, is male supremacy. We cannot fight what we cannot even name. And a logical corollary of the fact that female people have unique experiences is that female people have the right to claim their own space, to set boundaries of who can enter that space. And as a distinctly oppressed class, female people have the right to organize and meet autonomously from male people if we choose. And I believe that all oppressed groups have that right. I think that groups devoted to people of color that exclude white people are perfectly legitimate. I think that groups devoted to trans people that exclude people who do not identify that way are perfectly legitimate. The problem is that female people are not afforded that same freedom and that same respect. When we have gatherings that are based on addressing the specific exploitation that female people face, we get death threats. And as far as I know, that's yet again a unique female experience. That doesn't happen to other oppressed groups that try to claim their own space. And my question, again, is why? What does that serve? The answer, again, is male supremacy. We cannot fight what we are not allowed to organize against. So I'm going to move on to the next forbidden statement, I guess we could call them. So gender is an oppressive caste system. And this goes back to those two definitions of gender that I talked about at the start, and Lierre covered this even more extensively for people who were here this morning. Gender liberals make two arguments with regard to what gender is in order to defend it, and I'm honestly still perplexed by how some people can make both of these arguments at the same time, in the same sentence sometimes. So on the one hand, they'll say that gender is natural, innate, biologically essential. You're born with gender. And on the other hand, they'll say that it's voluntary and it's freely chosen. Think back to that birdcage. So I and other radical feminists disagree with both of these justifications, and I think they're horrifically destructive and misleading, but each in their own way. So proponents of the liberal definition of gender believe, sometimes, that gender is something that we're born with. And if a person's inborn gender doesn't match with the accepted stereotypes for the physical sex that we're born with, that person is born in the wrong body. And Children, toddlers, are being told that they are born in the wrong body if they don't conform to the gender stereotypes that are traditional for their physical sex. And I think that this is an oppressive form of biological essentialism. Oftentimes, radical feminists are called biologically essentialist, and this is yet another thing that I find infinitely perplexing, because we're not the ones saying that your body is wrong if you don't conform to stereotypes. The vision of the world that radical feminists are putting forward is where no one is subject to those stereotypes and no one's body is wrong, no matter what. So the only other groups of people whom I've heard defend gender as a natural, inevitable quality that we're born with, other than gender liberals who call themselves progressive, are men's rights activists and Christian fundamentalists. So forgive me if I don't see how that is remotely progressive. This is an adjustment, a repackaging of the traditional rhetoric of patriarchy. It is not resistance to it. So the idea that gender is natural is conservative, and the idea that gender is voluntarily chosen is insulting. Please tell a victim of corrective rape that her experience of gender is voluntary. Tell a woman who gets turned down for a job because she doesn't wear makeup or a bra that her femininity is voluntary. Tell any survivor of rape, the overwhelming majority of which are female, that being a woman is a fun set of clothing and aesthetic and behavior choices that she can reject and replace with something else at any time. Tell a preteen girl whose body is beginning to develop that the constant sexual harassment at school, the leering and harassment from grown men, the constant cultural messages telling us to starve ourselves, that's all just, you know, that's a choice. That's something you could reject at any time. That's part of your freely chosen identity as a woman. No. Gender takes the lived experience of being female or being male and reduces those experiences to sets of stereotypes. Transgender ideology, as it's currently being perpetuated, liberalizes that application by asserting that anyone can occupy those stereotypes regardless of the physical constraints, regardless of their physical sex. But that doesn't take away the destructiveness and the reductiveness of the stereotypes themselves, and in fact, it reinforces it. So gender is a set of stereotypes. It is not innate. It is a set of behaviors that you are punished for acting outside of. And I don't want to reform those stereotypes. I want to abolish them along with their destructive and toxic effects on our lives. The only way out of a double bind is to smash it. So I don't personally believe, and there are radical feminists that would disagree with me on this, I don't personally believe that every male person who identifies themselves as female is consciously doing so out of a desire to enact misogyny. I was a high school teacher for a few years, and I had male students as young as 14 and 15 that were told by psychologists and by doctors and by guidance counselors that because they didn't enact masculinity well enough, they were sick with gender dysphoria and they were put on very powerful hormones and told that their bodies were wrong. And I don't think that these boys were consciously out to invade female space or enact misogyny, but I certainly don't think that they should be turned into poster children for why gender caste deserve to be rationalized or maintained. You know, the punishment meted out to male people that don't conform to masculinity is severe, and I agree with Lierre. I don't know why the world doesn't stop turning. I don't understand how anyone can think that that's okay. But that's another effect of the gender caste system, and it is distinct from the systemic exploitation that female people experience because we're female. That is not to trivialize it, but that is to phrase it in a way that doesn't erase the reality of what female people experience. So gender is the chain and male supremacy is the ball, and just because males trip over that chain sometimes does not erase the fact that the ankle it's cuffed to is always female without variation. So the stereotypes of gender are not neutral, they're not random, and they're not arbitrary, as liberal gender ideology would have us believe. Just like the stereotype of the indigenous savage, which was made up by colonialists to justify exploiting indigenous people for their land, just like the stereotype of the lazy immigrant and the welfare queen, which are made up to exploit communities of color for their labor, the stereotypes we call gender are created and recreated by patriarchy for a specific purpose. And that purpose is to facilitate and justify the systematic exploitation of women. The mining of women's bodies for resources depends on gender. Oppression is always tied to resource extraction. Without variation, the reason for systematic oppression in society is to extract resources from groups of people. It is no coincidence that the male stereotypes we call masculinity reward aggressive, cruel, boundary-breaking behavior, because that is the behavior required from male people in order to maintain male supremacy. It is also no coincidence that the set of stereotypes called femininity include physical weakness and compliance with male demands. It is not a coincidence that the dominant stereotypes within femininity, domestic labor, selfless mother, infantilized sex toy, match up to the resources that female people are exploited for: cheap labor, reproduction, and male sexual gratification. And I don't need or expect everyone to agree with me on that, but the scare tactics, the bullying, and the threats, they're loud, but they don't make up the whole of the conversation, despite the best efforts of the bullies. In the last year, my views have also been simply criticized, often by people that I very much respect. I've been challenged, and I've been questioned, and again, I've been told that I am wrong. The reason that I still hold these criticisms, despite the criticisms I've received, is that none of those criticisms presents any evidence that these two basic principles are incorrect. So if you want me to stop organizing around radical feminist goals, which I hope none of you do, but it seems that many people do, your work is cut out for you. Convince me that one of these isn't true, and my predictive assumptions will yet again be thrown into confusion, and I will have to re-examine my feminism. So far, that hasn't happened. So I agree with Enloe again. I think that admitting my surprise is the only way that I'm going to be able to take fresh stock of my feminist analyses of developments both far afield and close to home. So come on and surprise me. Threats, slurs, smears, and uninformed dismissals are what I've come to expect. Constructive, sincere, adult conversation would be quite a surprise to me at this point, and I'm very excited whenever it happens, which is less often than I would like. I did not choose these politics for the hell of it or to piss people off. Naming the reality of male supremacy, naming gender as inherently oppressive, and defending the right of female people to organize autonomously comes with a cost. I and many others have come to accept that cost after critically examining the evidence and the theory that radical feminism brings. And for me and others in my position, radical feminism has been a lifeline of critical thought. We grew up within a version of feminism that uncritically accepted the inevitability and the naturalness of gender, the neoliberal primacy of individualism, and ultimately the unchallengeability of male supremacy in any substantive way. And we deserve better. Gender is not a binary, it's a hierarchy, and it exists to facilitate exploitation. This is the fact that we're not allowed to notice, much less speak out loud. We cannot fight what we cannot even describe, and that's why it's so important that we do speak this truth out loud in public every chance we get. Gender is an inherently oppressive caste system. It cannot, should not be reformed, extended, or embraced. If we want to end male supremacy, gender and the exploitation it serves must be abolished. Thanks, I'm going to pass it over to Heath.